On this week's 51%, a young woman in England is out to combat sexism worldwide.
So I really think that what we need to see is a kind of cultural tipping point away from the normalisation of sexism. And all it would take would be for two or three people on that bus that I was on to have said, actually, that's not okay, what are you doing?
Then we'll hear from a doctor about cancer prehab, and women on the fire brigade in France are far from numerous. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. But you're an animal, baby, it's in your nature. Just let me liberate you. You don't need no papers. That man is not your maker. And that's why I'm gonna take a good girl. I know you want it. I know you want it. Laura was sick of rude comments and inappropriate groping on crowded buses, so the young Londoner has been sending a clear message to other women. You do not have to tolerate sexism. Joanna Impey reports from London.
On the tube, a man asked my name and then told another man, if a girl called Lizzie gets raped on her way home, don't think it was me.
Laura Bates is checking through the latest comments on her Twitter feed on her phone in a North London park.
This one's awful, really shocking one that came in last night. Walking to school with my youngest daughter to collect my eldest at home time. Man comes staggering out of pub and daughter nearly runs into him. Sexy baby, he shouts, arms open, hips gyrating, leering. My daughter is 4 years old.
Laura now spends her time gathering such stories, whether serious or minor. The project started as a result of her own experience on a London bus.
I was on the way home and I was on the phone to my mum on the bus and a guy started touching my leg. And I got up and because I was on the phone to my mum, I vocalised what was happening and I said, you know, this person is touching me on the bus. And it really hit me that no one on that bus did anything. They all looked away. And it gave me this really overwhelming feeling of, oh, perhaps it's my fault. You know, no one's saying anything. No one thinks this is a problem. So maybe I shouldn't have been out so late on my own, or maybe I'm wearing the wrong thing. You know, those kinds of thoughts that you have.
What struck Laura in particular was how socially acceptable it was. So she asked her friends if they'd ever experienced anything like it.
I really thought that maybe a couple of women would say, oh yeah, I have this one incident from a few years ago, or I once had this job where this happened. And what actually happened just completely took me by surprise. Every woman I spoke to had a story. And it wasn't just from a few years ago. It was literally on my way here to meet you, or yesterday. And it was something that was happening so regularly, but like me, these were stories that they hadn't told anyone because they were just keeping quiet about it because it was so normal. And I just wanted other people to experience that kind of revelation I'd had of seeing all these women's stories in one place to realise it really was still a big problem.
So Laura started a website to collect all the stories in one place. A few women wrote in with their experiences. About a month later, Laura posted about it on Twitter and suddenly 1,000 people responded. The project was featured in a national newspaper.
And after that, the floodgates just really opened. All of the newspapers were writing about it and people started writing from around the world. And the number of stories coming in just grew and grew and grew until today when we get around 1,000 stories sometimes on a single day.
Laura quit her temporary job and focused on the project, making ends meet by selling articles to magazines. People began volunteering to help moderate comments on the website. Now Laura started actively raising money using a crowdfunding platform. She wants to make the website more user-friendly and to expand to other countries around the world. It's already available in 15 countries, including Germany, Russia and Brazil. Laura and her team successfully campaigned for Facebook to remove violently misogynistic images and comments, in the same way that they already remove racist or homophobic abuse.
It felt like a real milestone because we knew that Facebook had never responded not only to these protests but to anything really before.
Yeah.
And for them not only to respond publicly but to actually commit to every single condition that we had asked for in our open letter was absolutely amazing. I really feel that we're at a point now where people are not putting up with these things in the way that they used to even a year or two ago.
And that's not all. The Everyday Sexism Project is attracting the attention of politicians. I take the London Underground to Westminster, where Green MP Caroline Lucas has made a speech about sexism, in which she cited some of the evidence gathered by Laura.
I think the Everyday Sexism Project is absolutely fantastic because it demonstrates to women that they're not alone. And I think what Everyday Sexism shows is just this normalisation of sexism on a daily basis. And when you see it together, all drawn together, it is actually really shocking and it is a wake-up call. And I think we can use it to try to bring about change.
Outside the debating chamber, women start queuing up to tell me their stories of day-to-day sexism. I ask what impact the project has had on their lives.
It's such an important project because it encourages women to have a voice and speak up and fight back instead of just putting up with the things that happen every day.
For me personally, I think the internet is giving women a voice. The media is not giving women a voice, but we can finally find an outlet for, you know, what my daughter's experiencing here in her everyday life or what I've experienced in my business life.
Giving women a space where they can speak openly is clearly key to this project. But Laura's ultimate goal is to make sexism as taboo and socially unacceptable as other forms of prejudice.
So I really think that what we need to see is a kind of cultural tipping point away from the normalisation of sexism. And all it would take would be for two or three people on that bus that I was on to have said, actually, that's not okay, what are you doing? And it influences the whole group.
It may take some time before travelling on a bus, or anywhere for that matter, is a completely comfortable experience for all women. But Laura Bates is certainly doing her bit to take a stand for change. Joanna Rimpey, DW, London.
Cancer rehabilitation is perhaps more commonly known than cancer prehabilitation. Dr. Julie Silver, a breast cancer survivor, says cancer prehab leads to better outcomes and a better quality of life. She is the founder of Oncology Rehab Partners and an associate professor at Harvard Medical School in the Department of Physical Medicine. She is co-author of a review on cancer rehabilitation in an American Cancer Society journal and the author of the first comprehensive review on cancer prehabilitation published in the American Journal of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. She starts by describing cancer prehabilitation.
Prehabilitation has a long history in improving surgical outcomes. And one of the things that we've learned from looking at the studies is that it really helps to get people physically and emotionally ready for an upcoming stressor. When someone has a cancer diagnosis, they know that they're going to be starting treatment and that it's going to be very stressful physically and emotionally. So it makes a lot of sense to try to prepare them during that window of time when they're getting second opinions or getting biopsies tested and they're getting staged and so on, to try and prepare them physically and emotionally for the upcoming cancer treatments. Prehabilitation in oncology care is really evolving. Many hospitals and cancer centers are starting to implement prehabilitation services. In the past, there was, for example, preoperative education, and maybe someone would be given exercises. For example, if a woman was diagnosed with breast cancer, she might be handed a list of exercises that she could do on her own at home. But that's not really prehabilitation. Prehabilitation is really designed to improve very specific outcomes, and it's data-driven. So instead of just handing that woman a piece of paper with exercises, in a prehabilitation model, she would be assessed physically for problems with strength, range of motion of her upper extremities, baseline swelling of her arms to compare that later against the potential for developing lymphedema, and so on. And then she would be followed over time. Not only would she be followed, but she would be given very specific interventions to try to, for example, improve her strength, improve her range of motion, prevent post-operative complications, and even prevent lymphedema.
How would the emotional part factor into a prehab program?
The initial studies in prehabilitation really focused on pre-operative interventions, and they focused specifically on exercise. And over time, what researchers started to think about and really study was a more holistic and multimodal approach. So, for example, in a recent colorectal study looking at patients that were diagnosed with colorectal cancer, they used a trimodal approach, meaning that they used three different things. They used an exercise approach, so they had the patients doing specific exercises to try to improve their strength, but they added two other components. They added a coping or stress reduction component where they learned specific techniques to try to decrease stress, and they also supplemented them with protein for nutrition because they knew that by increasing their exercise, they were going to increase their protein needs, and also by undergoing surgery, they were going to increase their protein needs. So they really got them ready through this three-pronged approach to have a better outcome. And in fact, that's what they found. They found that the patients who had both the prehab and the rehab after surgery did better than the patients who had just the rehab after surgery. Of course, that makes a lot of sense, but having the research to prove that and then translating that into clinical care is really where we're at right now.
Can you even dissect that further and say, well, it's really working in this particular age group, in this particular cancer, female versus male? Are there any, is data that specific?
The research is really evolving, and the most research has been done in head neck cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, and colorectal cancer. Surprisingly, breast cancer, which has been very well studied from a rehabilitation perspective, has not been studied very well from a prehabilitation perspective. However, it makes a lot of sense, for example, in breast cancer, to prepare women for upcoming surgery and other treatments. Also, it makes sense even if women aren't going to have surgery, let's say they have advanced breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, and they're going to be starting chemotherapy or other treatments, then it still makes a lot of sense to try to get them physically and emotionally as strong as possible before they begin.
You're a breast cancer survivor, right?
Right.
Did you have this available to you, or did this emerge because you didn't and you saw the need for it?
I'm a breast cancer survivor, and I didn't have prehabilitation or rehabilitation. In fact, my oncologist, who was really wonderful at treating my cancer, said to me, you need to just accept a new normal and try to go back to work someday if you're able to. And to me, that was pretty devastating because I was really sick after I went through cancer treatment. In fact, like so many women who have breast cancer diagnosed, I felt really good at the beginning of treatment. Keep in mind that breast cancer is often diagnosed by a mammogram, or a woman who feels very healthy notices a lump in her breast. So they feel the healthiest at the time of diagnosis, and then as they go through treatment, get very, very sick, which is a common scenario. I remember having significant delays in starting cancer treatment because of the fact that I was getting second opinions and I was having further testing and so on, and that was a period of intense anxiety. It's a time of limbo, and limbo when you're trying to make decisions, and these are really life or death decisions, then it's very stressful. Based on my own experience and also being a rehabilitation physician, I realized that we really needed to change cancer care. And so I developed a best practices model called the STAR program that trains hospitals and cancer centers how to deliver both prehabilitation and rehabilitation services. So I work with literally hundreds of hospitals in the United States focusing on implementing prehabilitation and rehabilitation services that are evidence-based, meaning that these are the types of interventions that have been studied in the medical literature and have reported good outcomes.
Dr. Silver, can you point to specific data in terms of outcomes? Because you are speaking a lot about how much better the outcomes are.
One of our hospitals that is STAR program certified is Mary Washington Hospital in Virginia. And they have implemented STAR program prehab in their lung cancer population. And one of the things that they have been looking at is their hospital length of stay. So what they've seen is a decrease in the hospital length of stay for the lung cancer patients who have undergone prehabilitation. In fact, it looks like about a two-day decrease in the hospital length of stay. They're still collecting their data, but it's a downward trend, which is really impressive. One of the most exciting things that they're showing, though, is that some patients who would not otherwise be surgical candidates are becoming surgical candidates and safely having surgery because they had prehabilitation first. For example, one woman was diagnosed in her 70s with lung cancer, and she was told by the thoracic surgeon that she could have palliative care with radiation treatment, or she could have surgery for the lung cancer to try to have a cure. But he told her that if she didn't go through prehabilitation, she wouldn't be a surgical candidate. So she went through physical therapy and the prehabilitation interventions, and she significantly improved her strength and endurance and breathing. She safely went through surgery, and she told me that I knew I wouldn't have a very long time to live if I had radiation therapy only, and so I was going to do everything I could to have that surgery.
Isn't this all supposed to be a larger picture?
It is important for patients to have both prehabilitation and rehabilitation, depending on their baseline health status and what type of cancer treatment they're going to have. For example, if someone has a small skin cancer that is removed, they obviously don't need prehabilitation or rehabilitation. But for most cancer patients, they're going to undergo more significant treatment that will cause them to have many impairments. And one of the things we really want to do is to identify what problems they have in the beginning and what problems cancer or cancer treatment causes them over time. And we want to try to prevent or at least reduce the severity of these impairments, especially physical impairments that are really limiting their quality of life. So the STAR program uses a 5-pronged approach, and the prongs are as follows. The first one is general exercise to improve overall conditioning. The second one is targeted exercises. So, for example, in a lung cancer population, it would be respiratory exercises. In a prostate cancer population, it would be pelvic floor exercises to try to improve urinary incontinence. In breast cancer, it would be upper body, shoulder, and neck range of motion and strength. And in head and neck cancer survivors, it would be swallowing exercises. The third component would be the nutrition and the protein supplementation. The fourth component would be the stress reduction, specific strategies such as guided imagery, meditation, progressive muscle relaxation to try and decrease stress. And then finally, for those patients who smoke, the STAR program has smoking cessation as a component of the prehabilitation, not because we're trying to prevent cancer later due to nicotine, but because we know that smokers actually do worse when they have surgery in terms of trying to wean them off a ventilator, in terms of having more problems with wound infections, more problems with pneumonia that can increase their morbidity and even their mortality. So we know that stopping smoking even a short time before surgery or other treatments begin really improves health outcomes.
That was Dr. Julie Silver, creator of the STAR program certification, founder of Oncology Rehab Partners, and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. For most of its history, the Paris Fire Brigade has been all male. A branch of the French Armed Forces started accepting women in 2002. Today, the 8,500-member brigade counts 400 active female firefighters. Sarah Elzis meets one of them, who is keenly aware that she needs to adapt in what remains a male-dominated force.
Firefighter Lucille Morel is going out on a call. She grabs a walkie-talkie and heads to the ambulance parked in the courtyard of her firehouse. She and two other firefighters are headed to an office building in Puteaux, a city west of Paris, where they're based. They've been told a 25-year-old woman has severe back pain.
Douleur d'eau, femme 25 ans.
This is a usual call. The vast majority of a firefighter's job is first aid, but it's unusual in that Morel is in charge. She's one of just three women out of the 90 firefighters who rotate through the station. The Paris Fire Brigade is a branch of the military. They're physical tests to get in, and women do the same as men, almost. One tradition is the planche, the plank, a full-body pull-up onto a plank that's placed 2.5 meters off the ground. They do this every day. It's a test, says Morel. If you can't do it, you don't get to get on the truck. When it's her turn, she does the pull-up, just like everyone else. I chose to do it like the guys, she says. As a woman, though, she's allowed to do a pull-up and just hang there instead of going up onto the plank. Morel says this is to be expected. Women aren't built like men, but she says it's also problematic. We do the same job as they do, so we need to be able to do the same things. She says she always pushes herself to do it just like them. And she likes challenge. She grew up as a competitive judoka, which is why she sought out a physical profession. When I started, the men didn't really trust me, she says. She's tiny, just 48 kilos. Even today, after 6 years on the job, she still gets teased. As we were talking, colleagues came to the window of the office we were in and made faces at her. She laughed it off, slightly uncomfortable. They'd probably do it if she were a man, too, she says. But she thinks she gets more of it. Yet she says there is respect. They are, after all, military and respect her rank. Being female can be an advantage, too. Physically, she may not be as strong, but she can reach small spaces that her bigger male colleagues can't. And when it comes to victims, she says she gains trust.
Elles ont tendance à confier plus facilement à une femme.
They have a tendency to confide more easily in a woman. She says she experienced this recently when she convinced an elderly man to go to the hospital.
Nous, on arrive à trois.
We got there. There were three of us.
C'était sa femme.
His wife had called because her husband was a bit out of sorts. Turns out he had taken some pills.
Il était triste parce que ses enfants...
He told me he was sad because he never heard from his children.
Il voulait pas en parler à mes collègues.
She says the man wouldn't have wanted to say that to her male colleagues. But he confided in me, she says, and told me why he wasn't doing well.
Donc, du coup,
they talked, and then he came willingly to the hospital. Back on the call, Morel is in the office talking to the 25-year-old woman laid out on the ground who's grimacing in pain. As colleagues take the women's blood pressure, read vital signs, Morel quickly concludes it's a strong sciatic pain. Not life-threatening, but worth a hospital visit to get stronger pain drugs. They lift the woman into a chair, bring her down to the ambulance, and head to the hospital. Back at the station, Morel stands in a room off the kitchen of the first floor, the TV room. The boys have their PlayStation here. She says she often relates to her male colleagues through their families. I'm not going to talk about cars with them, she says. I don't know anything about that. So we talk about daily life, like our children. She has two. Unlike other male-dominated jobs, which are evolving to have more women, it's hard to imagine that happening with firefighting. It remains a physically demanding job that's complicated to manage with a family. It's a male profession, says Morel, and it's up to us to adapt. It will remain a man's world for now. Sarah Elsis, RFI in Puteaux.
Sarah Elsis produced this report for Radio France International. Another place where some want to see changing faces is the New York City Fire Department. Members of the New York City Council are urging the Fire Department of New York to step up its hiring of female firefighters. Currently, just 44 out of 10,500 firefighters are women. That's less than one-half of 1%. City Councilwoman Elizabeth Crowley called those numbers unacceptable. She chaired a hearing recently on barriers to increasing the ranks of women firefighters. Fire Commissioner Daniel Nigro told her and the other council members he has worked to improve diversity at the department in the 6 months he has held the job. Nigro said the goal is to strive for a firefighting force that is 15 to 17% female. He said he is confident the department can maintain its standards while ensuring that the hiring process is fair. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Chartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1328.